pilot.
Pilot? What's a pilot?
Well, the way they pick TV shows is they make one show. That show's called a pilot. They show that one show to the people who pick shows, and on the strength of that one show, they decide if they want to make more shows. Some get chosen and become television programs. Some don't, become nothing. She starred in one of the ones that became nothing.
Oh, man. After last week and discussing the epic pilot of Game of Thrones, it's hard to top such a huge scale show like that. But you know, we are going to end this week our HBO pilot series on something a little more grounded, right? Something to just, as Keith mentioned, cleanse the palate, or just to end a little more softly on something a little more down to earth. But what do you think, Keith? I mean, we talked about so many great shows that came from this legendary network, and it was just kind of like, it was almost like going back to school and learning just like a TV 101 as all these case studies of top tier show after top tier show, right? It was very educational.
TV 101. I like that. I think there's a lot of like, we talked about some amazing groundbreaking television and some pretty good shows. And you know, if we want to keep in the theme of, you know, traveling, you know, we went all the way to Westeros and then spent some time in 1920s Atlantic City and some time in Virginia with a washed up loser, some time with Larry David, Hollywood. We kind of went all over that. I hope with all the shows that we've covered in HBO and just in general, I hope anyone listening finds at least one show to binge and watch.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if we inspire people to watch a new show that they hadn't seen before, then that's very fulfilling, I think. It's, you know, not just for us.
That's why we do it.
Right, exactly.
That's why we
just like spreading the word about some great content out there. And especially with so many of the shows that we have been discussing, you know, this is kind of like the series on HBO. It's like the A side, right? The maybe first half of HBO's slate of shows chronologically. And we will return to HBO eventually and do maybe like the B side, if you will, from the early 2010s and to present day. But we'll break it up a little bit. We can only gush over this network's content for so long.
With a few sprinkled in between. I think you said like, oh, when we talk about Veep, it'll be more political. We talked about True Blood already. That was in way October. Like,
exactly. Yeah, it's the thing. You can focus on HBO, or if you focus on genre, HBO will just by naturally being relevant all the time come up with so many of their programs being so diverse. But it's funny, too. You mentioned how much we've traveled all over the place to different locations and time periods, and we're kind of ending where we started. So the first show we had discussed was Sex and the City, which took place in New York. And we're ending this pilot series with the 2012 pilot of Girls.
It's like we've been gone for 10 years and we're coming back and it's a whole new city with a whole group of people.
The new generation is taken over. And there are a lot of parallels with Sex and the City and Girls. I think it's a generational difference too. I mean, if you look at, you know, Sex and the City was about 30-something-year-olds in Manhattan, and here we have Girls about 20-something-year-olds in Brooklyn. And it definitely is the new generation. It's a very millennial show, not just from the characters, but I think, you know, the humor and just a lot of the relatability. Rewatching this pilot, it was almost painfully relatable in terms of the struggles and some of the faults too that our generation falls into these pitfalls with. And you know, it could be a funny show, but it could also be sometimes looking in the mirror in a way that is a little hard sometimes.
I had to laugh because I actually watched this show, and I think in lieu of HBO fashion, we talked about some heavy hitters like Game of Thrones last week. That, you know, Game of Thrones, and then it would have on like two comedies as like a good palate cleanser. This is a great way. This is a good show to end on.
Yeah.
But Lena Dunham and I guess Hannah kind of had her cake and eat it too. I used to laugh saying like, this isn't the voice of a generation. Now I kind of think it's not the voice, but it's one of many voices. It does speak to the millennial mindset.
Yeah, I think that it is a millennial story for sure. And it might have also perpetuated some stigma against our generation. Yeah, we are millennials. And in the 2010s, there was all this stuff about, oh, millennials, we're so entitled, we're so spoiled, we're so sensitive. But if you think about it, looking through the years, the flack that we got in our 20s as a generation is the flack every generation has in their 20s, you know, being self-centered and being narcissistic and all of those sort of cliches. I mean, that's what people say now about Gen Z.
Hell, and baby boomers are still the most spoiled generation. Oh, shout out to any baby boomers listening. And I've had many say that to me.
Yeah, it's the same old song and dance, really.
Yeah. It's just, like, that's how Gen Z is being treated now.
Yeah, for sure. And with each generation, it's a little bit different with the circumstances, but the overall stigma is usually the same. But here, yes, we have, I mean, the setting, too, in Brooklyn. That was the place to be in the 2010s, a post-college. That was so ideal, right? Like, oh, got to get to Brooklyn. That was such a scene. And, you know, just the struggle, you know, in the economy of the early 2010s as we were all getting out of college and finding a job, finding a place, finding our place in the world and trying to find out not just what we want to do with our lives, but what can we do? You know, what are our skills? You know, coming out of college and thinking to ourselves, dude, am I actually ready for what is out there? And in this show, the answer kind of is no for the main character.
Yeah, this is kind of like there's a narrative, but it's also like a slice of life. Like it's not so much like an avant-garde film but it presents as is. And if you were to continue, you would see like one episode would be entirely about one character taking a hike and no other characters would appear.
Yeah, there were some bottleneck episodes, right? As they're called, these sort of one-offs from the main story. But you know, you had your main four characters here and it was a very grounded show. I think realism is a word that comes up when I think of this show in a way that it almost doesn't feel like you're watching something scripted. It just feels very organic and natural. And that's a credit. Say what you want about Lena Dunham. I know she has had her share of controversies, but I would say that this is a well-written show in terms 100%. Of dialogue. Terms of themes and in terms of even its references, it's very self-aware too. I mean, the character, I think, you know, being that the character is a kind of like a loose version of who Lena Dunham is, you know, it's very honest in how flawed this character is. So it's funny too, because I got into the show a little later and I have watched all of it, but I remember when I hadn't seen it yet and people would talk about it, they would say all the time, oh, I can't stand Lena Dunham, but I do really like the show Girls. And that was a head scratcher for me because she is the show. The show is, yeah, the main character is her personality. She's the main creative voice behind the show. So how can you really separate the two and have such different opinions? But seeing it, I do get it. And it's kind of hard to describe, but when you watch it, you do see how the show can have appeal, even if its main character and its main creative voice is maybe not the most palatable.
I always found, like you said, the writing on the show is what drew me in, but also even the characters as mean and horrible. Like Marnie is legit horrible at times, and it's just like the situations that they find themselves in. I just found myself gravitating towards it. There's always that moment, and maybe it's like a mix of both of all like HBO, Judd Apatow and Lena Dunham. Like there's always that moment when it's like, oh my God, did you see what happened on Girls? Like there are moments that are striking both sexually, drugs, what have you.
I think at the core of all of those big moments are characters making bad decisions. I think that is the consistent thread. As much as these characters can be dislikable, from their attitude to the choices they make, they are still very identifiable and still very human. And I think that we can all relate to these characters in a way where it's like, oh yeah, when I was that age, in my early 20s, I did make a bad decision with a relationship or a job or a living situation, whatever it was. You know, it's that is, you know, people glamorize that age, that phase of people's lives, the early 20s. You know, it's like, oh, the world is your oyster. But it is a struggle for a lot of people. You know, you're just getting started. And you really don't know yet. Still, you're still growing as a person. Your brain is still developing. You are at the very end still of your adolescence, and it's a tough transitional period.
And also, if you can't relate to the characters specifically, you probably might have met one of these characters. I know we went to college in New Jersey. I don't know if they're still around, but hipsters were a big thing. And I'm not saying all these characters are hipsters, but the way there's definitely a bohemian, or trying to be bohemian, trying to be better than you kind of lifestyle, especially Jessa. But it's like, I bet, you know, we could easily go into New York, and a lot of those New Jersey and New York parties that I've been to, it just has that girl's vibe. And yeah, I met those people.
Right, right. The vibe is a little bit of an edge, but not quite there, because a lot of those people, like the main characters at least, they all come from a place of privilege. And so that's also part, I think, of the struggle, is a lot of them grew up in a place of privilege, and now they're on their own in Brooklyn, really having to face reality for the first time. And that's, again, where a lot of the struggle comes in, why the characters tend to make a lot of poor choices, is because they have to learn firsthand how to be self-sufficient and how to, you know, handle just real life situations that's, you know, you wouldn't learn in school, especially in New York. That's the toughest place to be to learn those lessons, but you'll learn them quickly. But if we want to maybe get into a little bit of the history here on how the show formed, it aired on April 15th, 2012, to 872,000 viewers. So again, a lower viewership, but at the same time, this show, you can classify it as a comedy. I do think that's what it was classified as, even though I do think it's more of a blend of drama and comedy.
The Judd Apatow factor, definitely, when you see it, it's like Mel Brooks being attached to something. When you see it, it's like, oh, comedy.
Right, and I do think it's one of those shows where there was word of mouth, and the audience is did grow. I mean, this lasted 6 seasons for 62 episodes. So yeah, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah, and it has like an ending that I think people can be satisfied with. And I know that Lena Dunham walked away with a couple awards.
Yeah, Golden Globes, and I think some Emmy nominations as well. So it was a show that was critically recognized, and it's one of those things where I think it was fairly fresh for television to have such a flawed and frankly dislikable main character, but that's the charm of the show. Almost the trick of the show is you're not really supposed to like the character that much, but you will still watch because, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of like watching a train wreck, but on the other hand, it is so well written that you do have to keep coming back, right?
Well, you're like yelling at the TV almost. You're like, oh my God, what are you? You're kind of rooting for this character to grow up,
right?
But they, for 6 years, they just don't.
Exactly. They tend to make a lot of repeat mistakes and a lot of selfish decisions that can be very frustrating to watch. But again, you keep coming back because, you know, they're right on the precipice. They have the potential for growth. You see that in them because they all have moments here and there of self-realization, right, where they understand, like, oh, I've really fucked up. But unfortunately, they keep doing so over and over again. But, you know, Lena Dunham, she had gotten her start making some online content, doing some web shows, but she finally had a breakout success with a 2010 film called Tiny Furniture. And that earned her enough attention that she was able to get a foot in the door with HBO.
Yeah, and got her best first screenplay at the Independent Spirit Movie Awards.
Yeah. And so this earned her an opportunity, and the network even set up Lena Dunham with an experienced showrunner named Jennifer Connor. And as you mentioned, Judd Apatow got involved. He first learned of Dunham through a New York Times profile, and that inspired him to watch the film Tiny Furniture. He enjoyed it. He reached out to Dunham to congratulate her, and they got to talking, and you know, he was learning about this project that she was developing with HBO. And when he heard that Jennifer Connor was involved, that also helped because they had worked together prior on the show Undeclared. So when Judd Apatow was offered to be involved in the show, he was very excited to do so, very enthusiastic. And this is, I think, like his production company is credited as behind this show, basically.
No, around like Judd started really like he started making big waves the same way like Whedon started making waves. Like he at one point he was like managing three shows, and at one point I think Judd had three shows not on HBO. I think he had Girls, Crashing with Pete Holmes, and Love on Netflix. Like those were all Judd Apatow productions. But every once in a while now, and I love this about him, he's such a comedy fan. He'll put out a documentary, a two-part or one-part documentary about he did a great one about Gary Shandling, and then I think he just put out one about George Carlin that was great as well.
He has
a great relationship with HBO. I think that started with this. By 2010, he at least for the 2000s, Judd, since 40-Year-Old Virgin, he kind of dominated. His name was attached to like all comedies.
Oh yeah, tons of big hits. And I think one of the calling cards of a Judd Apatow film or TV show is a very relatable depiction of how sex plays into relationships. And a lot of his shows and movies will tend to show like not the most glamorous sex scenes, but some actually very like relatable and realistic sex scenes. And they could be quite graphic, but at the same time, like, yeah, there's a focus on that element in relationships, and I don't know. He seems to have his thumb on how, like, you know, the dynamics between two people in a relationship is influenced by what happens in the bedroom and vice versa.
Yeah, not everyone's a model, and you know, everyone has those insecurities or troubles or highs and lows, basically.
Yeah. So, you know, that's part of being a good content creator is having a good handle on like real human interactions and relationships. So, you know, Lena Dunham, she did set out when she created the show to have a more realistic depiction of young women's lives. You know, she wanted to get away from the more glamorous depiction from, you know, prior shows and movies. And, you know, Sex and the City was one of those shows, at least towards the tail end, was a little more glamorized. And so she kind of wanted to, you know, do something that was the opposite of that. And she did base a lot of the story and characteristics in the show on her own life. And again, it does seem like a very honest show. As frustrating as it can be, at least it's not manipulative, right? The characters can try to manipulate each other, but no one's ever manipulating the audience. And so I think that is where I find respect for the writing and the direction of this show. It's very objective to how these characters are flawed and what their struggles are. It's never trying to emotionally manipulate you into, you know, siding with someone over a bad decision.
No, even in the show's biggest emotional moments, there's no score or anything. It's kind of like those moments tend to be soundtrackless. Like it just,
yeah, there's a soundtrack, but there's no score. Right. And that's the other reason why I think the show felt very relevant at the time, because they would have maybe some of these like indie artists contributing to the soundtrack. But yeah, there was never like an orchestral score to maybe add like a melodrama to it. It all felt very raw. And that was the other appeal. So there you have it. I mean, Girls, it does have this sense of humility when you watch it. It's like one of these shows that makes New York seem unglamorous somehow. You get like kind of the grittier side of the city. Even when you're in Manhattan, it just doesn't seem as cinematic. It does seem more lived in, which is hard to do.
The colors are a bit like, you know, if we're looking back at like Sex and the City, of course, like her dresses of whatever color are more vibrant and the colors in New York City are more gray, dark, drab. Like it, I don't think one criticizes the other. It really is just two different sides of girls living in New York City. One more rich who, yeah, as you said, like girls in their 30s who are friends, kind of have their life together. And then 20-somethings in the 2010s who are kind of, you know, really trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other big contrast, too, between girls and Sex and the City. The fact that in Sex and the City, the characters are older and they all seem to have a better handle on their careers. Right, none of them really seem to struggle with their careers. It really is just them focusing on their love lives. Or here, it's everything is a struggle, right? Their living situation, their love lives, their jobs, that they are all over the map, these characters. So that's another big difference. And I did mention when we talked about Sex and the City that that show initially had also like an indie feel for, you know, in the sense of what the 90s had going on. And eventually it felt more produced and glamorous as it became more of a successful franchise. I think here they were able to maintain the same look and feel throughout the entire run. And yeah, I think it's appropriate too that it does have kind of like a grayer look to it because, yeah, again, in the early 20s, it's easy to feel lost and the world doesn't seem so bright and shiny as it did when you were a kid. You get such a hard slap of reality that does very quickly seem like a much darker place.
Yeah, this isn't one of our longest histories. It really is just like, you know, Lena Dunham made a really great film and people noticed and she had a lot more to say. And yep. And a lot of the right people got in touch with her.
Right. Yeah, she did catch her break and we did get this solid show, I would say. You're right. It just goes to show that good writing will find its way and
always.
Yeah, and it's the base of another solid entry into HBO. So here we go. It is April 15th, 2012. We were both still in college at the time, and everyone's starting to talk about this show as soon as it airs. So, Keith, you can now take us to the pilot.
Flight 527, runway 8 kilo, you're cleared for takeoff.
All right, so in our first scene, we meet Hannah. She's at a restaurant having dinner with her parents, Lorene and Tad.
Played by America's mom, Becky Ann Baker from Freaks and Geeks. She played Ted Lasso's mom. She's just, if you need a great mom. And in this show, I think she gets so much to work with over the course of the season. And so does her dad, who is played by Peter Scolari, who a lot of our parents would know played opposite Tom Hanks in Bosom Buddies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I never saw that one, but now I have to.
You know
go
the
back.
Premise, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're cross dressing yeah, yeah. in that one. Yeah, for sure.
You know, they want to stay in this all girls house for cheap. And it's like, well, how do we stay in? And, you know, they dress up for like two seasons.
Man, and then no one caught on, right?
No one caught on. It was a wild time back then. But yeah, he was the not Tom Hanks guy.
Okay. And then, so you do get a good sense of Hannah's relationship with her mom and her dad. It is different with each parent, as it tends to be with most kids. You know, Lorene has a funny quick line here with Hannah as she's scarfing down her food. She goes, yeah, slow down here. You know, you're acting like the waiter's going to take it away. And she says, I'm a growing girl. And that's a really great first line. I think that's her first line in the series. And it's a truer line than she realizes. And, you know, Tad and Lorene, they have news for Hannah. You know, first they ask how her job is going, her job, quote unquote. And she assures them, you know, it's going well. They're going to look at my writing soon, which is all great and everything. But Tad and Lorene still have to tell her they will no longer be financially supporting her moving forward. And Hannah is a little blindsided by this. She tries to guilt her parents into changing her changing their minds. Like, that's
not emotionally fair. manipulate. Like, she, like, you know, I'm not a drug addict. I don't get abortions. I could be a drug addict. Or, like,
yeah, like,
you know,
oh, yeah,
it is to get pills.
My friends who aren't supported by their parents, yeah, they are on drugs. They get abortions.
But
Sanders' mom's like, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
They pay for everything. Not the rent, insurance, phone plan. And the lack of realization from Hannah is just like, like, Jesus, how long did you think this was going to go on?
Right. This goes right into that sense of entitlement. She feels like her parents should be supporting her, because Hannah, she doesn't really have a job in the traditional sense. She has an internship, an unpaid internship. So she needs some sort of financial support, and she's been getting that from her parents for 2 years now, they say. She graduated from college 2 years ago. She's still working an unpaid internship, and enough's enough. You know, they really need to stop enabling this this lifestyle she has where she's not going anywhere, right? She's a little too content in this situation to have her parents just giving her money to do whatever. And again, she is trying to plead to their sense of, you know, I'm still your daughter. You know, I'm your only daughter. And this kind of works on the dad. You know, he kind of agrees with some of Hannah's points, and Laureen has to shut it down immediately. Like, you are too spoiled. You are going to have to support yourself moving forward. And, you know, Hannah, in a moment of spitefulness, says, you know what? I don't want to see you guys again the rest of the time that you're in town for.
But because every mom likes being the bad cop in this situation. But yeah, no, she kind of has, like, I, over the course of not only this episode, but the series as well, you kind of see the family dynamics at play. The dad, who is wearing an earring and is not mentioned at all, but is,
I noticed that. Yeah.
There's a shot that's like a close up shot, and it's very prominent. That I do think kind of plays into his character as we get to know him.
Yeah, but that his character definitely takes a turn later in the show. But we also get a little more insight. Hannah's parents are both college professors.
Yeah.
So they're making a point, like, we can't really afford to fund your lifestyle for that much longer. I mean, we have our own financial goals as well. You don't know what our financial situation is. You know, it's one of those things where she just assumed her parents had maybe like a bottomless bank account from which that she could tap into perpetually.
But hey, I'm an only child, and my parents, my mom especially, did a lot to break any stereotype someone might have of me being spoiled. Like, I've been working. I was a paper boy when I was 13. But yeah, no, she, you know, Hannah's a little bit spoiled. But also,
a little, very spoiled.
Yeah, I'm being nice here. But her dad is, you know, a little bit of a, you know, I'm sure there was like that daddy's girl relationship. And the mom, you know, probably sees a little bit of herself and just hates that. Like, she kind of, she sees the path that Hannah's going down. It's very interesting what you can draw out of this first scene alone.
It's a great first impression in the fact that you know right away what kind of person Hannah is, especially with her attempts to emotionally manipulate her parents. You can tell she's done this for many, many years to get what she wants.
Yeah.
It's not a great first impression in the sense that we are not going to like this character, but it gives you a great idea of who she is. And then this is where we get the quick title card, Girls. That is what we see in every episode, is a cold open followed by the title overlaid at the end of the scene.
Do you know how crazy the economy is right now? I mean, all my friends get help from their parents.
We are sympathetic to that.
But I'm your only child. It's not like I'm draining all your resources. I mean, this feels very arbitrary.
You don't know anything about our finances. I mean, we're professors, Hannah, professors. You know, we can't keep bankrolling your groovy lifestyle.
My groovy lifestyle?
The bills add up. We're covering your rent, your insurance, your cell phone.
You said it was cheaper for you if I was on the family plan.
Yeah.
So next, in the next scene, we see Hannah waking up in the same bed as her roommate and best friend, Marnie. You can tell they have a very close relationship. We also get a quick shot of another friend, Jess, arriving by taxi at her cousin Shoshana's apartment. But for now, we're going to be staying at Hannah and Marnie's apartment. Her boyfriend, Charlie, is in the kitchen. He tells them, like, oh, I overheard you guys listening last night to the Mary Tyler Moore show, another great reference to a female-led show. And it's a little awkward. You know, Charlie and Marnie, they're in a relationship, but she is a little
cold.
Right.
I think if you were to meet them, you'd be the, like, huh, oh, they're seen together?
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of awkward around here. She's a little cold to him. And there's a really uncomfortable moment when he kisses her cheek, and it's a little like a family member kiss, not really like a boyfriend kiss. It's a little odd. And then we get another shot here where we move on to Hannah and Marnie in the bathroom. And they're very close, where Hannah is naked in the shower and Marnie is there shaving her leg. Yeah, Hannah almost demands that Marnie get naked too, just for the friendship, intimacy. And, you know, Marnie is going on about how she thinks she should break up with Charlie. Yeah, she doesn't feel it anymore. And Hannah's like, well, you know, he loves you. You know, how does it feel to have someone who loves you? And Marnie just doesn't feel it back.
Which is, I think, a fair thing. I think anyone right now could be like, okay, it's time to break up. Like,
right.
You know, people just fall out of love, and it looks like this is Charlie's, like, first relationship, and not only, or at least, like, first real relationship, and not only that, he's with a girl as beautiful as Allison William. Like, he's so much in love with her that it's cringy.
Yeah, he doesn't really know how to be around her, right? He probably puts her up on a pedestal. And yeah. I do want to call out, though, Allison Williams, I think, is the actress I've seen the most from the show after it. And a lot of people saw her in Get Out. She was really good in that. I thought she was excellent in Megan that came out last year, I think.
She's a very good horror movie actress.
Right.
But I think she's a very good actress.
She's a very good actress in period. Although it seems like she's becoming a scream queen.
We can always use another.
Yeah, exactly. A great legacy there with Scream Queens. And then, you know, Charlie comes in. He's a little taken back, coming into the bathroom and seeing Hannah naked there. She has no qualms about it. And he says goodbye, again, very awkwardly.
Yeah, he's so like, oh my. He, like, covers his eyes. And granted, you know, hey, I would be – if I was in Charlie's position, I'd be like, huh, my girlfriend has slept in – her best friend's room while I slept on the other side and is now taking a shower with her. Is it her or friend or me, or maybe all of the, like, and he doesn't get anything. He doesn't see anything weird about that.
Well, he just goes along with right?
He goes along with, yeah.
He doesn't feel like he can maybe voice his opinion or should have one. He's just catering to Marnie. So then we cut a little bit later to Marnie and Hannah about to walk out to start their day. You know, Marnie is encouraging Hannah to ask for a paid position at her internship. You know, she's been working there for over a year. She should ask, you know, to be made a more, like, official employee. Is that so much to ask? And then as they're walking along, you know, Marnie and Hannah, they're talking about how they're going to have a dinner party that night to welcome back Jess. Marnie is not as thrilled as Hannah. You know, they're remembering some instances of Jess's reckless behavior from back in college. So, you know, Hannah is much closer to Jess than Marnie is, and we'll see why. You know, Marnie and Jess are really two different sides of the spectrum in terms of, like, you know, personality, in terms of their outlook, their demeanor. So it's interesting to see Hannah have two close friends who are so different from each other.
But I think that's where Marnie feels a little bit threatened. It's like, oh, I'm your best friend, but so anytime that Jessa comes into the mix, like, you become a different person, or you become more of her best friend. Meanwhile, Marnie is just kind of left, like, you could kind of, at least that's what I saw.
Yeah, that's, like, a good point. Threatened is a good way to put it. And the other thing, too, you get a sense that Marnie is more of a planner, more of a structured person. Jess is more of a chaotic person, and you can't really plan things around her, right? She doesn't really ever, you know, commit to any sort of plan or what have you, right? She just does things off the seat of her pants. So now we go back to Jess arriving at Shoshana's apartment. Jess and Shoshana, they're cousins. And Shoshana is she has an apartment in Nolita. She's a student at NYU, correct?
Yeah, she's trying to become like a if I remember correctly, like she actually is like her schooling has been is like stays with her throughout. Like studying abroad, I think was a big with her. But I think didn't she want to become a lawyer or something like that, like public service?
I just remember that I think the last two seasons she enters the workforce. But yeah, from like at least the first half of the show, she's a student. So she's the youngest of the main characters. And her connection is being cousins to Jessa. And very bubbly personality, maybe not necessarily Jessa's cup of tea. So Jessa, you know, she gets a big welcome from Shoshana, who's just talking a mile a minute. And Jessa's like, can I just get something to eat? Can I put my stuff down? Shoshana's going on about how great her apartment is, how great her rent is. She shows off her Sex in the City poster. There's the reference there to the prior HBO show. And she's going on about like, oh, you know, I think you're kind of like a Samantha mixed in with a Carrie. I think I'm like a Carrie, but sometimes Samantha comes out, da da da. And Jess is like, you know, I haven't watched it. haven't seen it.
That's where it's like, Jess not only says I haven't watched it, she's not even aware of it being like, oh, is it a movie? Is it a TV show? And like, look, I know people, some stuff can go over people's heads, but I remember I was at a party once in college, and I think it was a guy, but I met a guy version of Jessa, and it was like, you know, I don't watch TV. I don't have it. I'm like, don't lie like that. To me, that's one of the biggest lies. Like, you do watch TV.
Right, right. They're a little too, they're trying too hard to show that they're non-conformists, basically. So like Jessa too, it's like, oh yeah, I'm not on Facebook. You know, I don't watch TV. You know, she's trying to be like she's too cool for school, right? To do what everyone else does.
And whereas everyone praises her. Everyone kind of loves her for it. Like, oh, right, I get to go to Europe and travel and go to Amsterdam and France.
Well, it is kind of refreshing. Like, ooh, someone who's really operating outside of what everyone else is doing, whereas Shoshana is the opposite of Jessa in the fact that she is doing what everyone else is doing, and she is very much someone who conforms a lot more. And also, you know, Shoshana, she's a sweet character, but she's also a very aloof character and probably the most naive of the main four, even though she has probably the best intentions. But she definitely has her moments of just making very bad decisions. Again, just maybe a lack of experience.
If I remember correctly, and granted, like you're right. She's like aloof, naive, and just like, wasn't she like at the start of the season? She's a virgin. That is like all the I remember that being a topic of conversation for her,
yeah.
And she's very insecure about it.
Oh,
and
yes,
she's trying to find that like right person.
Yeah, exactly. And she's a little more she sees romance a little more as like a fairy tale, right?
Yeah.
Another way that she is a little more of a conformist.
And when you have a cousin like Jessa, like that insecurity is just knocking at your door all the time.
Right. Yeah. It's easy to feel intimidated by Jessa and her way of life. So, you know, Jess mentions one more thing here in this scene about how when she was traveling around Europe, she met this surfer guy, and Shoshana's like, oh, did he like you? And she's like, yeah, you know, I guess, but that'll come back a little later. So in the next scene, we see Hannah at her internship. She's at her desk, and she goes up to her boss and starts a conversation here. You know, she's like, yeah, I can no longer afford to work for free. And he kind of takes this the wrong way, like, oh, well, we'll be sorry to lose you. Like, that's it, and goodbye. And, you know, she's like, no, like, you know, I still want to be here, but, you know, you did hire the last intern, so I was hoping. And, yeah, the boss is saying, like, you know, the last intern, she knew Photoshop. And it's, like, one of those really tough moments that you learn when you get out of school, like, oof, like, I need more practical skills here. I have an education, but I need to learn some things that are a little more marketable on a resume.
I 100% don't blame her for trying. Like, this scene is realistically funny because I think you just needed to make it into a scene. But damn, does it shine a light. I would like to think internships have changed, but damn, does this scene shine a light on how, like, just not the, like how nowhere some internships can be.
And oh, just like, absolutely.
Like
and this is
not even stipends.
This is the part of the show that I found painfully relatable because I did some internships that were unpaid. And
me
I,
too.
Yeah, I was like a very shy person that was afraid to maybe speak up and advocate for myself more back then. And yeah, you could tell how her boss strings her along. Like when she first approaches him in this scene, she's like, you know, I've been here for over a year. And the guy says, well, yes, you are invaluable to us. But it's like, if I am so valuable, then why aren't you paying me? You know,
and she tries like this, like, oh, can I mind if I send you my book? He's like, well, who would read it?
Like, well, it was his thing is like, you know, when she was interning there, he said like, oh, yes, I will read your book and give you my opinion eventually. Again, another way of stringing her along. And when they come to the conclusion, well, I guess she has to leave now. She doesn't want to intern anymore. He goes, well, you're not going to be with us anymore. So, no, I won't be reading your work.
Man,
you know,
what a piece of shit.
It just goes to show that, you know, this guy doesn't feel like he owes her anything. And that's another thing, too. When you're young, it's a quick lesson you have to learn. The world does not owe you anything. You can't just assume that if you work for free at an internship that you'll be rewarded in any way. There's a good chance you won't be. And so, you know, they agree that, you know, she's going to be leaving. It's you know, an unfortunate end for her that she has nothing to show for all the time she put in at this internship. And as she's leaving, the previous intern is like, oh, where are you going? Can you get me a Luna bar and a vitamin water, please? You know, she's or the previous intern is asking her to do more, you know, bitch work intern stuff, which, again, is very typical. It's like how quickly she forgot where when she was in that position herself.
It's like one of those moments where you're like, am I like, you're such in shock. Like, wait, am I fired? Like, did that just happen? Like,
yeah,
because he's like, it happens so fast that you're like, but yeah, no, that is a scene that a lot, if not most, millennials can relate to.
Yeah, for sure. I think nowadays it depends on where you are. But in New York City, at least, I think there is some sort of law or what have you that says interns must be paid. So that is a good thing. Wish that was a rule earlier when we were interning,
yeah.
But what can you do? We are where we are now.
Scenes like this help get that law passed.
Well, that's very true. We had to suffer for the next generation.
As you know, I've been working here for over a year.
Has it been that long? Well, you are an invaluable part of our operation.
Which I recently learned means very valuable as opposed to not at all valuable. And I wanted to let you know that my circumstances have changed and I can no longer afford to work for free.
I'm so sorry to lose you. I was just going to start you manning our Twitter. You have just the quippy voice for that.
Oh, no. I'm not quitting. I just, I know that Joy Lynn got hired after interning, so I thought that maybe.
Hannah. Joy Lynn knows Photoshop.
So Hannah, now she calls up her boyfriend, Adam, and tells him that she's on his way.
Boyfriend's a little loose. I would call him a fuck buddy.
Like, oh, okay, yeah. She calls Adam the guy that she sees. That she's on her way to his house. And yeah, when she gets there, this is where we meet the character Adam, played by Adam Driver. Actually, yeah, I said before about Allison Williams being the most seen actor from this show. No, it is Adam Driver that is the real breakout actor after this show.
Not with that haircut, though. I forgot that goofy looking haircut in the beginning, but.
yeah, he grows it out eventually.
Well, he's supposed to be this, like. Okay, he's the actor of the group, but he is also like a woodworker. He has the weirdest apartment.
Yeah, he is a weird guy. I mean, this is another great first impression of this character, and there are people who are like this. My impression of Adam was always like this very carnal kind of person. Like, he just, I don't know, he's even more chaotic of a person than Jessa is. And he doesn't take anything seriously, right? He's very unpredictable. And so, you know, Hannah is with this person and, you know, it's a very toxic dynamic that they have. But
Marnie doesn't like him either. Like, he's like, oh, because once again, she feels protective of Hannah and threatened by Adam, only in the sense that Adam can be a little like the fact that he doesn't text, like Anna just seems longing for him.
Yeah,
He's just nonchalant about their relationship. Oh, yeah, you can come over. Like,
the fact that he's harder to reach almost makes him more attractive to Hannah. And again, like Jessa, he's another person that just kind of operates outside of what most people are doing if he doesn't really answer texts or is hard to communicate with. It's fascinating, but it's also kind of frustrating. So they're having a conversation here where Hannah will tell him, you know, I got fired from my job today. You know, I'm not. He's like, oh, you mean your internship? You know, they asked you not to hang around there anymore. He's making some good points, but he's also very insensitive about it. She tells Adam, she makes a confession. You know, I was getting all my money from my parents, and he's like, oh, it's okay. You know, I get all my money from my grandmother. Sends me $800 a month, which in New York City I don't think is nearly enough to get by still.
But like he's kind of like, oh, I'm not a slave to anybody. It's like, all right, you get yeah. it's that kind of like hipster hypocrisy that like a lot of that just mindset exposed. We're laughing at him. We're laughing at his like way of thinking.
Right, because he has almost an arrogance about thinking how he's above the system. Right, I won't get a job because I won't be anybody's slave. Well, you know, that's all nice and everything, but how exactly are you living your life then? And so, yeah, Adam and Hannah, they're on the couch there, and yeah, they start to get intimate. And while Adam and Hannah are kissing, she's also being a little more talkative. She's lamenting about not having any special skills, and she's not prepared. Adam's not really listening to her. Yeah, he just wants to get her clothes off. He goes off to get lube, and orders Hannah to get totally undressed. And you know, she's like, "Are you gonna wear a condom?" And he's like, "I'll consider it."
Yeah, he has. You know, I always say these. I even wrote the note. I'm like, they kind of connect, but don't. Like, there are times where they're like, oh, he helps her. He's listening to her and he's giving her his own version of good advice.
Yeah.
But then like he is someone on a mission and just for selfish, he's basically taking advantage of her,
Absolutely.
good nature or some nature, whatever, good or whatever.
Hannah's attraction to Adam, I think, is also rooted in the fact that he's the kind of guy that your parents would absolutely not approve of. Like, they would hate this guy. Because he is so radical and just does not have anything together and is definitely using Hannah to a degree. And so, you know, like he does wear a condom, but he does want to have anal sex as opposed to, you know, vaginal sex. And
HBO, baby.
Yeah, that's HBO. That's Judd Apatow for you. But yeah, Hannah is like, no, I don't want to have that. And you know, Adam does relent, and so you have a sex scene there, and then
and it's still pretty uncomfortable for her. Like, it's still like, yeah. I don't like, you know, the way they're talking to each other. It just looks like no one, or at least she's definitely not enjoying it.
There's a disconnect there where he even says like, how about we play the quiet game? He doesn't want to listen to what she has to say, and he even has her in the sexual position where, you know, they're not. They can't see each other's faces. He's not really looking at her. And it is, you're right, it is a little uncomfortable. There's like a lack of true intimacy there. And then after sex, you know, they're back on the couch. And, you know, Adam does ask Hannah about all her tattoos. And we get a little more insight into Hannah that, you know, she got all these tattoos on her body in high school when she was gaining weight. It was like her way of retaking control over her body. And that sounds to me like something that the real Lena Dunham did too, because those are her real tattoos. And you know, again, this is a lot of the show is based on her own experiences. So that sounds like almost her, like a confessional to the viewers about her true self.
Now, Adam does grow as a character. Like, you know, I think it's very great to see all these characters grow at some point. But in this first episode, he's such an asshole in this scene. Such an asshole.
Yeah, another character not making a good first impression in the sense that we don't like him, but yeah, we get a good sense of how chaotic of a character he is. And you're right, he does start to take things a little more seriously in terms of his acting ambitions. You know, he wants to be an actor, and he does have stronger feelings for Hannah as time goes on, but they're very, you know, it's a very destructive relationship that they have over
but
the course.
But those tattoos mean something to her and like have a deeper meaning. It's like, yeah, I would get him lasered off. Like, it's just a completely dismissive and once again, not really listening to her, like has his own ideological worldview on things.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, I think you kind of summed it up. Like, she is everything that her parents, like, if they were to meet now, they would freak out even more.
Yeah, exactly. That she, a lot, some young women, that's a good thing. You know, that's an attractive feature. So in the next scene here, Charlie and Marnie were with them. They're in the kitchen again. And, you know, Charlie is trying to get Marnie aroused, you know, like, you know, what would turn you on right now? And, you know, she doesn't really know what to say. Like, well, what would turn you on right now? It's very coy, but it's something that a boyfriend and girlfriend who's been together for a while should know by this point. And they don't
but
really.
But it's what she says. It's like, oh, how about you be a stranger? Like, someone that's completely different from you.
You and not be yourself. Yeah.
It doesn't even register. And if, like, if I heard that, I'd be like, all right, can we talk? I don't think.
You yeah,
don't
that's
like
an issue.
Me. I don't think you like me.
Yeah, it's like she's not even asking to role play. It's like, just don't be you. Be anyone but you. And that's a red flag. They're interrupted by the doorbell. And Charlie says, oh, that must be Ray. And Marnie is not really happy to hear that Charlie invited Ray. He's like, yeah, I thought we'd have more people. You know, it's only four. It's not much of a party. Marnie's like, it's dinner. It's not really a party. And Ray and Charlie are cousins? Is that their relationship?
I thought they were bandmates.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure, because Ray is older than the rest of
he's their older. The cast. He's the older friend of the group, I think. I do believe he manages a coffee shop. I remember that.
Yeah.
The coffee shop ends up being this a big part of the show. But I do believe they're bandmates. I don't remember. I could be wrong. Any
yeah,
girls
they might
fans,
be...
reach out to us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there might
no,
be.
No, Charlie was in a band, or is in a band.
That must be it. They were bandmates as well. But again, he is older. But you know, we'll meet him soon. I Ray is one of the more likable characters on the show. I would think
he's just as lost. But I did tend to relate to him more. Not watching it this time, but I just always liked that actor, and just kind of wanted to see where he would end up. He's just as lost as the 20-somethings.
He, to me, what I like about Ray is he seems like an old school New Yorker, like an old school Brooklynite before all the hipsters moved in. Like, he's like the more, you know, just kind of like down to earth guy, just trying to do his thing. And yeah, he might have been a band and whatnot, but he doesn't really have any airs about him, which is what I enjoyed.
He's the Apatow factor. At least, like, he's one of those characters that would have that comment that would make me laugh at the situation. He knew how to make that snarky comment. But like, I thought he was the more comic relief of the group and I'm laughing with him.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, not everything goes his way all the time, I do like that he does have his focus and some really good storylines later in the show. So during dinner, you know, Marty's annoyed because only Ray and his girlfriend or his date, whoever this girl is, they're the only ones who showed up. Hannah's not even there. She can't reach Hannah. Jessa isn't there, right? She has these two friends who are not being reliable. But finally, Jessa arrives, and Marnie throws her keys down to her. And you know, and then also Hannah arrives very, very late. Very excited to see Jessa.
Ray also made a no sex comment. So it's a well-known thing that, like, it's like one, everyone knows that these two should break up.
That's right. And that's like a really ballsy thing to say in front of a couple, is making a comment like, oh, you know, Charlie would just like to get some.
I think he just wanted to see the reaction.
Right. But not a very appropriate thing to say.
So Charlie McDonald, you should work at McDonald's. It's great. It's fucking incredible. You know how many people McDonald's feeds every day? You know how many people it employs around the world? Plus, they make an incredible product, okay? It tastes tremendous. It's affordable. It's fucking consistent. I can walk into a McDonald's in Nigeria, order chicken McNuggets. When I bite into it, you know what it's gonna taste like? It's gonna taste like home.
That doesn't mean I have to work there. I went to college.
Yeah, I went to college too. You know where it left me? I have $50,000 in student loans. That's how deep in debt I am.
And then we cut to a little bit later in the evening. You know, Hannah is worried about how she's going to run out of money. She's saying, you know, I could probably survive in New York for a few more days with what she has. And she's like, oh, man, I'm going to have to work somewhere like at McDonald's. And Ray's like, hey, you know, there's nothing bad about working at McDonald's. They make a great product. It's like, yes. But Hannah's like, I have a college degree. Yeah, I can't be working at McDonald's. But you know what? That's maybe better than not working anywhere.
But Ray, this is where we also get an insight in just the millennial life. Is like, it's like, Hey, I have student loans up the wazoo. My major turned out to be nothing. And Lord help, like, I don't even need to say that that's a current problem in our society.
Absolutely. I mean, even Adam had a comment before too about how he went to school. He has a degree that he also finds to be useless.
Ain't that something?
Yeah. And so Ray, he is going on about McDonald's, how great they are, while making a tea. And not just any tea. He's making an opium tea from like opium pods that he bought from a flower shop. Apparently it's perfectly legal. But Marnie is not too happy about this either. She's like, oh, great. You brought drugs into our house. And, you know, Charlie and Hannah, they're like a little intrigued. Like, okay, yeah, we'll have some. He warns them, like, it tastes like twigs. And Hannah mistakes that for that. Oh, I thought you'd say it would taste like Twix. Very different.
But once again, Marnie is very like, Hannah, you're not good with drugs. Like, it's she's kind of like her keeper.
She's trying to mother her or be like an older sister to her. But, you know, at the same time, she might have good intentions for Hannah. But it's the same thing. Hannah is bad with authority. She doesn't like listening to her parents. And so she's not going to really listen to Marnie giving her similar kind of advice.
I don't want to play like armchair therapist. But when you have that kind of mothering big sister relationship for someone who needs to grow up, that is kind of regressive.
I agree. You kind of just have to let them do their thing and then learn on their own. You can't mother a friend like that. Hannah tries the tea here, so she is going to feel the effects very soon. And a little later, we see Marnie and Hannah in her bedroom. And Marnie's giving her some interesting advice. You know, just tell your parents that you need them to support you for a little while longer until you get a job. Like, you're working to get a job. Just help me out a little bit until then. But then Jessa comes in and gives her very different advice. Tells Hannah, you know what? You're an artist. Just embrace that you're an artist. All these other artists, they had to struggle for years before they got to where they are. So just embrace that. And that's two different sides of the coin, right? Like, should you tell your parents that, you know, you are trying really hard to do what they want you to do? Or should you be a little more defiant, right? Jess is giving her very defiant advice. And not really advice that's going to get Hannah where she wants.
And Hannah, in the meantime, is on the up roller coaster of her highness. Like, she's just – the roller coaster is just going up and up.
She's taking it all in, and she can't really make sense of
– Everyone's right.
One piece of advice or the other. She calls her two friends sex goddesses and just kind of leaves. You know, she's like, I got to see my parents. And Marty doesn't want her to. Like, you're very high right now. I don't think that's a good idea. But she leaves anyway. And I thought Jess had a funny line as Hannah's leaving. She says about Hannah, she's in a good place.
I like what she said in the beginning. Like, is Charlie single?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's just another – like, it could be both just a comment or a dig at Marnie.
Well, you know, this show is full of very quick moments. And it almost warrants a rewatch because a lot of this is – a lot of the plot is driven by dialogue. A lot of the jokes are very quick one lines that are picking up, you know, people picking up on situations in a very subtle way. So it just goes to show that as a writer, I feel like Lena Dunham has a really good handle on just how people observe certain things, energies, vibes. It's how you make an impression on other people, like the way that people view you. Is sometimes not what you expect.
And she knows how to have characters who opposing, like many characters who think differently, and also just can write that dialogue seamlessly between them.
Yeah, and you know, the last thing I'll say about that too is I think she's really good at establishing how a character views themselves, and then seeing how other characters view them, and getting the contrast there. That is set up in a very subtle but effective way. Now at a hotel room where Hannah's parents are staying, Hannah comes in. She is very high. They don't realize that yet. You know, she's like, oh, I'm very hot in here. She takes off her coat and she's telling them, like, I need you to read my book right away, immediately. And they're like, very taken aback, like, well, we thought you didn't even want to see us, but okay. And they start taking a look. Back at the apartment, Marty and Jess are in the bathroom, and you know, Marty is saying, you know, Jess, your advice for Hannah, that wasn't very good. And also, you know, you're late all the time. You know, she's really railing into Jess here, and the two are getting into an argument, you know, just from having the opposing viewpoints and you know, the way about them. But Jess has some information from Marnie. She informs her that she is pregnant, which is some pretty big news.
And Marnie's like, was it planned?
Yeah, was that on purpose?
Like, yeah, they're just trading barbs of like, it's like, I'm her best friend. Well, you don't own her. Well, at least I have friends. Like, and you're
yeah, Marnie is like, you don't value what it means to be a best friend to someone because you never stay in one place for enough time to have a best friend. But again, Jess, yeah, she is so against any sort of label. Like for her, the term best friend doesn't really mean anything. Like she doesn't care about the sanctity of a best friend. She just wants to do whatever it is she wants to do. And any sort of labeling has no meaning for her.
But I think, like, the show is called Girls, and it's about girls. It's not about girlfriends. Like, these girls, I think how they will feel about all four of each other throughout the course of the series will change, like, from one start of the season to the end. But, yeah, no, it's like, they may hate each other. Like, and it's not, like, or never even liked each other in the first place type of relationship.
The status quo of this group is very fragile, I'll say that. And you mentioned the title too. You know, it's called Girls. And I think that's very clever because obviously it's about young women. And, you know, young women can call their friends girls. But at the same time, I think by calling it that, it's also reflecting how emotionally stunted these young women are. Right? They're very childish. Oh, yeah. In a lot of ways, especially Hannah, the way that she still tries to manipulate her parents like she probably did as a teenager. So there's a bit of that too. It just goes to show that these are characters who need to grow up. So back at the hotel room, you know, Hannah's parents, they're reading her work, and you know, they seem to be responding positively to it. She's like, yeah, you know, I'm going to finish it. I just need some help. If you maybe could give me $1,100 a month for the next 2 years, that would be really helpful. And her parents, her mom especially, it's like, that is ridiculous. There's no way. But by ridiculous, Hannah thinks, oh, I know, $1,100 isn't enough to get by in New York. Right? She thinks it's ridiculous for being too low of an amount, not being too much.
And once again, the dad is like, this is his baby girl, and he doesn't like to see her hurt. He doesn't like to see her in pain.
No.
But like the mom, Becky Ann Baker, sees right through that.
Right. She knows her daughter, like you said, because she sees a lot of herself in her daughter. So she knows the kind of tactics that Hannah is going to be using to manipulate them. And then Hannah, you know, she comes overwhelmed at this point from her high, and she falls over. She basically collapses. Her parents are like wondering what's going on. She confesses to drinking opium tea. And so her parents, yeah, they kind of take that on the chin, like, okay, I guess.
I like how the dad is like, oh, he's basically like having banana peels.
Yeah. He's like, I know what that is.
You'll have a coffee.
Yeah. And, you know, at this point, Tad is like, you know, we have to help her. I hate seeing her this way. It's like when I had to watch her get a shot and she hated that. But Lorraine is like, shots make people healthy. It's good for you. And that's a really good analogy. You know, we have to do the tough thing for our daughter, because that's what's best for her. Yeah, it might be painful at first, but it is for the best.
But like, you know, they did everything that they, or at least what they thought right as parents. Like, they got Hannah through college, and their mindset is like, you're supposed to be working and doing things for yourself, probably like what they did. And of course, times have changed, but you know, I think the mom is ready to retire. Like she wants to retire. She's just like, I want a lake house. I want to not worry about like the expenses in New York. Like no one needs to tell anybody that they add up.
Oh yeah.
Month by month. And I'm like, it does, like, you know, it's not even like utilities, Metro card. Like they're not even mentioned, but you could just even assume food.
I mean that, yeah, not just even groceries, but I assume that Hannah goes out, right? She goes out to restaurants and to bars, and she's spending her parents' money on that kind of stuff too. She's not, it's not as if she's living a very like you know, conservative life here, like trying to make every dollar go as far as she can. I get a sense that she takes this money very much for granted. And that's why she's so flippant about it. Like, what's the big deal? Just give me money. It's like, what is
money,
it?
Money, please.
Yeah, I was about to say, Mona Lisa from Parks and Rec. So, you know, Lorraine, again, she ends the scene saying that, you know, Hannah is very spoiled and we need to see through that.
I will say, as much as, like, you can hate Hannah in the moment, the fact that she's doing, like, this, woe is me, oh me, oh my, she's on the floor, like, I hate everything, like, oh, so, it becomes, like, all right, whatever, I thought you were in trouble, you're clearly overdoing it, girl.
Yeah, she's coming on too strong with it. And, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, with her parents, like you were saying, they thought they were doing what was best for her. Like, okay, we will pay your way through college, and ideally you will get a paying job after that from which you can then just start funding your own life and being independent. But, you know, to be fair, 2012 is just 4 years after that recession, and it was not an easy thing to get a job, even in a place like New York City. It was a much more competitive market, so... Yeah, that's another thing that our generation definitely struggled with, too.
And she probably sold, like, and like, I'm sure everyone celebrated when she got an internship in something in her field. Like, that's something,
right.
Like,
it's
hey,
relevant.
This is like, she probably, you can kind of predict the conversation before, like, hey, this is going to lead into a job and I'm going to be a working person.
Right. And that's why it strings people along so much, these unpaid internships. It's like, it's relevant to what you want to do. And you keep being told this will lead to a paying job. But, you know, ideally, if you do have to do something that's unpaid just because, you know, you think it's relevant and will be good experience, you should also still be doing something else that pays the bills. So in the last scene here, it's the next morning. Hannah wakes up in the hotel room by herself. Her parents have left. And yeah, this is like the most selfish that we'll see her in this episode. Yeah. It's really bad. So yeah, she calls, she picks up the phone and she calls the front desk. She tries to order room service. Like, I'd like to have some room service, please. And you could tell that the person on the other line is telling her, like, well, you know, the people who had this room, they checked out. The account's closed. You can't add anything else to the bill. You know, she was expecting to run up her parents' tab here.
One last time.
Get one more free meal. But she's like, okay, fine. I'll just leave. And she notices there are two envelopes that her parents left on the nightstand. Both have money in them. One says Hannah. The other one says housekeeping. She takes money from both envelopes. And then she leaves. And that is... really the key moment, I think, in the pilot. This is a very selfish person who is making very objectively bad decisions. Like, yeah, she's not a good person. Like, a good person wouldn't do that. And that's a big struggle for a lot of people, I think. You know, traditionally, you want your main character to be likable. And here, in Hannah doing this, it is... you know, that's such a souring moment. Like, I remember the first time I saw that and I just audibly groaned, like, oh no, don't do that.
That's the kind of laughter that this show elicits. Like, oh, Jesus Christ.
But it is so important. And it's a great moment for a pilot because it's really an unexpected moment because you're like, okay, she's really selfish, but how bad could she be? Oh no, just you wait. She, you know, taking a housekeeper's tip is one thing. But you know, she's going to continue to make much more destructive and selfish decisions as the show goes on. And, you know, it's a good way to subvert people's expectations. You know, if you think you're going to like the main character of every show you watch, that doesn't have to be the case. You can have a dislikable main character. As long as their story is interesting, that should be more important.
If the stories and the dialogue and the characters are interesting, like, I wouldn't call Hannah an anti-hero, but she is our protagonist. And yeah, not every protagonist needs to be like a good go-getter type person. And, you know, Lena Dunham saw a lot of herself in this, and it is a statement on millennials. Granted, it's not the best statement, but no, I think it is an honest statement. And like we said before with this pilot, like all these situations, even when something like opium tea, like, you know, we've all been to college. Granted, I've never seen opium tea at something, but like it all feels real. Even when it's a little extraordinary or some of these situations, I think that's the point of having a television show as well. But it does feel grounded, and you do get to see these characters grow over time. I'm happy the show did have the success and word of mouth for it to grow. And, you know, Hannah says to her parents, "I would like to be the voice of a generation." You know, I think when people say that, it's kind of shooting yourself in the foot, a little grandiose, but
yeah, you can't really declare yourself to be a voice. That's something that more is declared much longer afterwards by future generations.
Watching this pilot again, though, I'm like, it's a bit of a voice. Like, I'll give Lena Dunham that.
I think it captures its time very well. And, you know, maybe they're giving millennials a bad name, but you're right. It's taking things further, which is another great thing you can do in TV is, you know, take a typical kind of person and maybe exaggerate some of those flaws in a way to make a point. And you know, the last scene we see of Hannah is leaving the hotel. There's a homeless guy telling her to cheer up. You know, you should smile.
You remind me of New York. Hello.
This like upbeat guy. She just ignores him, and we're in Midtown. She's going to be heading back home. And that's the first episode of Girls.
I think that I may be the voice of my generation. Or at least a voice of a generation.
And even in that shot of Manhattan, like I mentioned before, it doesn't seem as glamorous. It seems dreary.
And yeah, juxtapose that with the ending of you know, the sexy jazz of Sex in the City, the saxophone.
The more stylized playing. Ending
and this
of
is
that.
Just, she gets lost in the crowd.
Right. And I do think it is a low moment for the character. It's almost like hitting rock bottom. Like, you're that desperate for money that you're going to take $20 from a housekeeping tip. You know, that it, you know, she's desperate in that because she doesn't know when she's going to get her next $20 bill. Like, she doesn't know where her money's going to be coming from. So I understand the temptation to do that, but then to actually do it is, you know, just such a shameless thing to do. But again, it is something that people probably have done, maybe some spoiled kids. And again, this is a show that is going to double down on realism. And, you know, I do think, too, with Lena Dunham's writing, there's a lot of literary references, right? Like, you can tell this is written by someone with a literary background. Even some of her references, like earlier in the episode, Hannah and Marnie were talking about an author named Gustave Flaubert. You know, like, oh, I'm like Flaubert. And I was like, I don't know who that is. I did not study literature, but I looked it up, and he was a French novelist from the 19th century who was like one of the main like proponents or founders of the literary realism movement. And so like that, it's a good reference to make because that is the style she's going to be going for, right? Is just like pure unfiltered realism.
Hey, there's a little bit of me in that. I mean, like, not that I would bring out a Flaubert, but I got in with the hipsters because not only was I, you know, some of my major was an English major, but I read a lot of the Beat Generation.
Yeah.
So that was always like a good topic. Kerouac, Burroughs, Ginsberg. I could talk about it with the best of them.
Sure. I mean, you know, in another life, maybe I would have shown a little more interest in studying these you know, very prolific authors. But certainly someone with a writing background, you know, what makes you such a good writer is having being so well read and having your influences. And I think Lena Dunham is someone who shows that she has that wealth of knowledge from all different literary genres. And this particular genre of realism in literature is probably her biggest influence, at least the one that she's injecting into this show. And yeah, it's just funny too, contrasting this with Game of Thrones that we watched last week, because you go from like such a high production show that is this medieval fantasy to this much more toned down, grounded, low budget show that's based in the world that we live in. That's very familiar.
I think that's why, how I would recommend this show. If the pilot at any at all interests you, I think you should definitely continue further. But this is not going to, it's not going to go to any epic places, like Westeros, of course, but I think it will entertain you. It's a good palate cleanser. It's good after you watch a Game of Thrones or a Boardwalk or a Big Love.
It goes to a lot of emotional places, right? And that could be epic in a different kind of sense. Like, there are some high emotional stakes for a lot of the characters, especially our main four. And it could be very painfully relatable a lot of the time. And so, yeah, you can feel that. And I think we could all, even, as much as we can dislike these characters at times, it's still sometimes cringy to see them just make decisions that will haunt them for a long time afterwards.
I think that's the best thing about TV, though, because, you wouldn't have a show called if no one was Shameless, you wouldn't have a show called Shameless on it. They kind of need to make the bad decisions. But I think what works for all these characters is that they make, we've all kind of made these bad decisions before. Maybe it's in some way.
And, we've all maybe deluded ourselves at one point, right? Because the way Hannah talks so much throughout the show, when she's clearly in the wrong, and she will gaslight people, she will manipulate in all different kinds of ways to make herself seem like the victim, when in fact she is the person who's causing an issue. We all have known someone like that, and we could see the wheels turning in her head. That is something that people will do to not accept accountability in their lives, right? They will deflect. And so when you watch it, it's frustrating, not just because you're seeing this character who's refusing to grow. She eventually does. But also because we've experienced that. We know that these people are real, and it is frustrating. It's a frustrating reminder that the world is filled with these kind of people who don't want to ever accept responsibility for their actions. But it's a good way to end our series here on HBO, just coming to a place that you could see the full circle moment here between where the network was really starting to get popular in the late 90s, and seeing how they always had their thumb on popular culture.
10 years worth of knockout television, changed television.
Yeah, the evolution.
Gold standard, exceptional, top shelf stuff.
The evolution of the network from this era, 1998, from the first pilot we discussed to 2012. It was a real pleasure to observe that and see how each show made its mark in the history of this network. So there we have it. We will return to HBO eventually, but we're going to take a little break and come back in a couple weeks with a new series, a new topic. And there's so many different genres of TV, but I think one that has been very persistent throughout TV history is that of the hospital drama. Or just the hospital setting is always a place people go to. There's tons of shows over the years about doctors, whether it's a drama, a comedy, or something in between. So I'm going to call the next series we are discussing Doctor's Note. We will be there in a couple weeks with our Doctor's Note, where we are being prescribed all these pilots that center around the medical profession. What do you think of that?
I had no help in this. I always wait, are we done with the podcast?
Yes, we can keep talking.
Okay. No, I'm just doctors know. I'm still kind of like, damn, that's so fucking clever.
Go with that pun. Prescription.
You're going with
theme.
It. I can't wait.
Yeah, that should be fun. But we'll be back in a few weeks with that new series. But thanks everyone for listening and going down this journey with us, and hopefully continue with us for many more to come. So we'll catch you in later this month at the next pilot. Follow us on Instagram and X, formerly Twitter, at Take Us to the Pilot. That's Take Us to the Pilot with the number 2.
Attention passengers, we've now reached our destination. We hope you enjoyed the flight and have a nice day.